we got a house in the Hollywood Hills, Sammy Davis Jr.'s house, and recorded an album in the pool house there. The record company thought I was out of my mind.
Alcohol, drugs, brotherhood, and the making of some iconic music in a new documentary about Robbie Robertson and the band. And Kerry Washington produces a documentary about four ACLU attorneys fighting the Trump administration.
I keep referring to these lawyers as our Avengers. You know, they are really these superheroes taking on such powerful figures, and they're doing it in such a heroic manner. But superheroes are all people who tap into their extraordinary power.
Plus, presidential candidates make a Hollywood house call. It's The Frame Weekend from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. We'll be right back. Welcome to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Coming up later in the show, Democratic candidates and President Trump have made trips to L.A. this week. We take the pulse on who in Hollywood is backing which candidate for the White House. But we're going to start today with singer and songwriter Robbie Robertson. The story of his legendary group, The Band, is told in a new documentary. It's called Once We're Brothers. Here's a cut from the trailer.
If there was any American musicians that were comparable to what the Beatles were, it would have been them.
When they came together, something miraculous occurred.
We wanted to create something you have nothing to compare to.
The film features interviews with Bruce Springsteen and Eric Clapton, as well as archival footage from the band's history. You even get a peek of their iconic Pink House in upstate New York, where they made a lot of music. Last fall, when Robertson released a new album, I went to see him at his West LA studio, and we were surrounded by a dozen guitars hanging on the walls. I'm going to play a bit of the song, Beautiful Madness.
Oh, it looks like I'm meant to.
This is a song that deals with drug addiction, and in your documentary, drug addiction is a huge part of the story of the band, about what happened to Rick Danko, Levon Helm, Richard Manuel, about them becoming addicts. And I'm thinking about that song, about what addiction meant to you and to witness it and what it did to your friends. How do you go about taking something that is that personal and make a song about addiction?
Well, it's interesting now when you look back on it, because back then marijuana was considered the same as heroin. And so because of that, a lot of people thought, so what's the difference? Let's try this, let's try that. We knew nothing about it. We knew nothing about alcoholism. We just thought, don't you think you're drinking a little bit too much? Why don't you cut back? Everybody thinks, oh, I can handle it. And that's what you would hear over and over again. But in this group, there was something about that addiction that really got in the way of our brotherhood and really got in the way of this was a band that if all five members weren't on point, it just didn't work the same. And trying to lift up one side of it that was bent over and everything was a big job and a hard job and a heartbreaking job too.
When you guys made Big Pink with a band, it was a novel idea to actually leave the city, hole up someplace, and make music there. And I'm wondering if you've retained any of that, to isolate yourself from outside noise and figure out where you do your best creative work. We're in your studio now. Is it here? Is it somewhere else? How do you insulate yourself in a way that seemed to work so well on that album?
That was a dream of mine, to have a sanctuary we got a house in the Hollywood Hills, Sammy Davis Jr.'s house, and recorded an album in the pool house there. The record company thought I was out of my mind, but I knew something about these guys that nobody else in the world did. And I knew that if we had our true, unique surroundings, that we could go to a place. And when we came out of that place, we had made music unlike anybody else in the world.
That isn't the only thing that happened 50 years ago. You guys played a little concert at Woodstock. And people who've seen the Woodstock concert movie probably don't know the band played at Woodstock.
When we went and played, it was at 9 o'clock, the last night of the festival. It was the height of the festival. There was 500,000 people in the audience. And when we got there, you could see that everybody was out there. They wanted to rock. They wanted to rip off their shirts. And when we went and played, it was like somebody coming and doing hymns. It was more of a spiritual. So you saw this go out over the crowd and everybody completely go to a different zone.
They say everything can be replaced. They say every distance is not near.
But we hadn't played hardly any concerts as the band. So then there was cameramen running around the stage and sticking a camera up in your face while you're doing it. But our manager, Elver Grossman, said, no cameras on the stage. We are not going to have that. This is a different kind of thing.
When I watched the documentary, I was thinking not only about how the band sounded, but about how they were a family in many ways. And to watch the film and think about the early deaths of some of your friends and the more recent deaths of people like Levon Helm, what does it feel like to lose a family that way? Because the band breaks apart, you go off and do your thing, but then to lose these people who are so close to you, you're still here, you're still doing music. How does that affect you?
Well, I wrote a song called Once We're Brothers because the idea is hard for me to imagine that I could have lost Richard Manuel, Rick Danko, and Levon Helm. That I could, you know, that part of this brotherhood is gone forever. And it touches a deep part in me. And I needed this therapy or whatever you want to call it. But for me, it was a way to express my love for this brotherhood and these guys that we did such amazing things together.
Robbie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, John.
The documentary about Robbie Robertson and the band is called Once We're Brothers. It's in select theaters now. You're listening to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn.
You can't go on. You'll miss your brothers. But now they're gone.
When a massive fire broke out on the Universal Studios lot in 2008, hundreds of master recordings by significant artists, including Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, and Judy Garland, were destroyed. To this day, the full extent of the damage still isn't known. Fortunately, there are record labels devoted to preserving and releasing old recordings, so our music history doesn't get left to chance. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving learned how it's done.
My name is Cheryl Pavelski. I'm the co-founder and owner of Omnivore Recordings, and I'm a historical record producer.
My name is Michael Graves. I'm a mastering engineer. I specialize in audio restoration.
I visited these two at Graves' house in Altadena, which is his makeshift restoration studio. One room is full of reel-to-reel tape decks. A dehydrator oven and a record vacuum. In the back is a mixing board and a digital workspace. Graves' job is to take old, sometimes ancient recordings and give them a sonic spit shine.
Okay, so this is a Hank Williams. This is right off the record. Okay. Now, play it on a nice turntable with the right needle, vacuumed record, and then it's gone through all my digital restoration, and we end up with this.
Well, all you want to do is sit around and pout, and now I got enough. Omnivore puts out historical music across all genres, from popular country artists like Hank Williams to a never-before-released album by Harry Nilsson to 1970s West African funk. Whether they're releasing it digitally, on CD, or on vinyl, Cheryl Pavelski says they always try to go back to the earliest, purest source.
Now, some of those sources may be digital, right? But the preference, if you're going to make a vinyl record in 2019, is source it from analog. So it's all analog in the chain. So you use an analog tape, and you cut the acetate on a lathe that has the capabilities to skip any digital stage.
In the case of the Hank Williams record, though,
the sources are acetates.
Acetate discs are basically old school phonograph records.
And a colleague of ours digitized these recordings in the late 80s, I believe. That's what we worked from. We still have the sources to go back to, but they had deteriorated to a state where the digitized versions that he made 25, 30 years ago are better than what the originals are right now.
So even analog purists have to concede to digital sometimes. Like Pavelski, a veteran Grammy-winning producer who worked at Rhino and EMI Capitol Records before she co-founded Omnivore in 2010.
Digital technology has gotten so good that high-resolution files, it's inaudible, the difference. It had to be proven to me because I was very much the purist and wanted to stay all analog. But eventually, as the resolution and the bit rates and everything got better, you know, somebody sent me some test pressings one time that were all high resolution, digitally sourced. And I just had to say, this sounds fantastic. So sometimes you have to introduce digital into the chain. And if it's done properly, it's not a bad thing.
Digital restoration also means that if the original source deteriorates or burns up in a fire, the recording lives on. It's hard to know what all was irreparably lost in the Universal Fire, but Pavelski knows at least this much.
Well, the ability to go back to the stone cold original, you know, if you want to make copies from something, you don't want to make a copy from a copy, right? If copy tapes didn't exist, if safeties didn't exist like they don't on a lot of multi-tracks, then you actually did lose original music that you can't get back. Alternate takes, outtakes, studio chatter. That's the kind of stuff that is completely irreplaceable.
And when it comes to preservation, digital doesn't mean safer. Computer files are perhaps even more impermanent than analog media, and I should know. I first interviewed Cheryl Pavelski and Michael Graves for this story back in July, and somehow lost the recording. It's a good thing I wasn't Hank Williams' engineer. For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving. And now I got enough, and gal, I'm getting out, I'm leaving. I'm leaving now. Coming up, why Alfred Molina said yes to starring in the play The Father when it came across his desk.
Well, first of all, you're assuming I have a desk. So that's the first mistake.
The British actor is next on The Frame Weekend. Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn, and not far from where I'm sitting at KPCC is the Pasadena Playhouse. It's where a new production of the play The Father is now on stage. Alfred Molina stars as a man lost in time and place. Furniture appears to rearrange itself. People look drastically different from one moment to the next. Time is moving, but not in a straight line. Molina's character has dementia. And it's an illness that sadly has affected the actor's wife. Before we got into the details of The Father, Molina shared his secret for auditioning.
I used to pride myself on turning up at auditions and giving the impression that I had somewhere better to be. Because I always believed that the last thing you want to seek at an audition is any kind of approbation or any kind of, you know, thanks or compliment.
I suspect you didn't audition for this play, but the play lands on your desk and you read it. Why did you want to be in it?
Well, first of all, you're assuming I have a desk. So that's the first mistake.
Coffee table, bedside table.
What happened, in all seriousness? What happened was I was involved in... Oh, by the way, have we started?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, okay, fine. I've got to turn on my proper voice now. No. What happened was I had been in conversation with our mutual friend, Jane Kaczmarek, and I had just or was about to move into my new home, which isn't all that far away from here. And the Pasadena Playhouse was our local theatre, and I was keen to work there. She introduced me to Danny Feldman, the artistic director. He then got in touch with me and said, look, here's a list of plays that we're considering. And straight away, the first one on the list was The Father, Florian Zeller's The Father, I should say. And it became the obvious choice.
You have a play as written, and you have a life as experienced with your wife. How do those two overlap, and what information do you take away from what you've seen with your wife that informs the way you approach this character?
Well, the experience obviously informs the work. It can't help but do that. But also, I've used that experience. I've used it sort of hopefully creatively and in a way that's respectful. And one thing that I wanted to do, one reason why I wanted to do the play was that I wanted to turn the last 10 years of my family's experience into something tangible, into something that we can be proud of. I remember years ago when I was still studying, when I was at drama school, I remember one of my fellow students got very badly injured and had to drop out of school for a while. And one of our teachers said, any creative person's obligation is to turn pain into art. And that's what I'm trying to do.
We're talking with Alfred Molina about his play, The Father, which is now at the Pasadena Playhouse. This is a story about a father, and it's a story about that father's daughter. And for people around my age who have parents who are still alive, that might be in their late 80s or their 90s, this play is also hard to watch because it's starting to touch on issues that are starting to become factors in their lives. And watching this play with a father who is sharp, but, is approaching 90, is really challenging. And I'm wondering, as a child of somebody who is older, what do you think this play has to say about how we deal with people who are going through memory issues and what we can learn from it about how we talk and understand them?
Well, I think, I'm not an expert on dementia or Alzheimer's or anything like that, but I do know that we're reaching epidemic proportions, certainly in this country, and more and more people are going to be touched by it in some shape or form. But I think what we understand by seeing a play like this and experiencing an evening like this is the inevitability of it. That, touch wood, your dad will stay sharp as he gets, as he gets older and he may deal with other frailties, but he'll, if he still knows what a piece of toast is, that's fantastic. And I wish him well. But the truth is, for many, many people, it's going to be, it's a journey of diminishing returns. And those mosaic tiles keep falling off, and all we can do is just try and be there. I think it's interesting, for instance, that over the last few years, most of the research into dementia and Alzheimer's has shifted from trying to find a cure to looking for more effective preventative measures to, at least put it off longer or detect it sooner, which is, I think, a much more effective way of dealing with it. Because at some point or other, we're all going to get it. At some point or other, something's going to get us, and sort of being, forewarned is forearmed, I think.
the physical manifestations of your character on stage are also noticeable. When we first see Andre, he's doing a crossword puzzle, that he's dressed to the nines, he's moving confidently, and as the story progresses, and we don't really know over what time period, that's kind of a mystery, or at least, open to interpretation, he's unable to get dressed, or he's kind of developing some erratic movements. When you're thinking about the physical manifestations of what you wanted to communicate, what was your approach and what did you talk about with your director?
Well, a lot of it was what I witnessed with my wife. The physical decline. She was, a very vibrant, very active woman. She was an actor, a writer. She was engaged in life in a very positive and joyous way. And as a family, we watched her decline, and I noticed there were certain things that I noticed with other people, who were going through the same thing. There are certain physical changes that are universal, it seems, to everyone who, the shaking and the change in one's gait, for instance, is very, very noticeable. The way that a person who may have stood up strong with a good strong upright spine suddenly walks with a curved spine and walks kind of with a sort of shuffle. All those things are very typical, and it was really just applying it in a way that was appropriate to the character. I'm certainly not ashamed of it. Although I remember when my mother passed away, my brother and I were at. She was Italian, so she had an open casket, a very traditional kind of burial. And people came and paid their respects. And I said to my brother, I'm going to remember this moment because it might come in handy one day. And I wasn't ashamed to say that. I'm an actor. That's what I do, And I knew that this moment had there was a profound basis to this. This moment was meaningful, and it was something that I know I could use. And my brother got very angry with me, but I did the same thing here. I tried to turn the experience that we all had into something that's hopefully in some way cathartic and artful.
Alfred Molina, so good to see you.
Thank you.
Alfred Molina stars in The Father. It's at the Pasadena Playhouse through March 1st. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. The LA post-punk band French Vanilla makes dance music with a message. With song titles like Bromo Sapien, it's clear that the band has a sharp sense of humor. But the underlying themes of queer identity and gender bias couldn't feel more urgent. The Frame contributor Allison Wolf spoke with bandmates Sally Spitz, Daniel Troutfield, and Ali Day about their most recent album, How Am I Not Myself?
My name is Sally Spitz, and I sing and I write for French Vanilla. There's a window, there's a chance.
There's a window, there's a chance. My name is Daniel Troutfield, and I play bass and saxophone.
My name is Ali Day, and in French Vanilla, I play guitar and bass, both of them. We've been definitely evolving as musicians. The first album, we made those songs, some of us having never played instruments before, essentially.
Carrie. For the song Carrie.
A shy girl who doesn't make friends easily.
That song is a reference to the film starring Sissy Spacek based on the Stephen King novel Carrie. I was very struck by that storyline because I had experienced abuse, hazing when I was in high school. And I had these very vivid memories of locker room and the auditorium and these venues that are in the film that are so quintessentially high school.
I feel like that's the most divisive song we have. when we like open for like maybe like an all male band and it's their crowd, they'll just be staring at us like, what?
You're a woman now, Carrie.
Yeah, there's just nothing quite like looking out, pouring your heart out, and then seeing some teenage guy eyes like glazed donuts looking back at you.
Right.
You
yeah, because we pretty going on in pretty there. Explicitly talk about menstruation, and that doesn't play that well to an all male audience.
Yeah, I mean, they don't have to encounter death monthly.
We're all very sorry, Cassie.
Me and Allie grew up in Lompoc, California.
We went to high school together.
And to prom together. And I think to a homecoming together, too. Oh.
Just prom, babe.
But we're not dating because I am gay.
We went as friends.
Yeah.
Although he was not out to me, so.
I mean... Wow. What is the definition of a friend? What's the definition of dating?
Okay, so we were dating?
Maybe we were dating.
Is that what you're telling me?
We went to homecoming. Okay, so.
No, we went to prom.
That was probably the biggest band nerd in my school. I was the drum major of the marching band, which included me having to dress up as a Jedi at high school football games. Many of my early memories are on the band bus. Friendly Fire is my favorite song. Those are some of my favorite lyrics because I think it's like my echo from the speakers.
I hear a rumble.
In the bleachers. Bleachers remind me of marching band because we used to like perform on the field at football game shows, and you would kind of hear ostensibly my saxophone reverberating and coming back to you on the field.
This is Allie. Growing up, I was never really encouraged to play music. My brother always played guitar, and I actually remember saying to him one time, I hope that you like become a rock star one day. Like, it somehow never even occurred to me that I could be the one playing music until I was much older. And it wasn't really until college when I had friends like Sally over here that I started having my own dreams of starting a band.
Our new album is called How Am I Not Myself?
Another super crush, I can't control it. I want another heart, and so I stole it. The way you look at me, so deep into my eyes.
This album, it had in large part to do with like a queer, like sexual awakening that was pretty delayed. You know, I had a lot inside that I hadn't really explored or considered.
It's kind of scaring me. I wanted you to see.
The album and writing like lesbian songs is stepping out of the expectation and the norm for me, and it was very exciting and liberating.
Other bands were like, oh my god, when you go on tour, you guys are going to kill each other. And then when we went on tour, we get along so well. It's just a pleasure.
I mean, we were friends first, bandmates second, and future frenemies.
Even more future business partners. Even more future buried next to each other.
That piece with the band French Vanilla was produced by Allison Wolf. I'm John Horn, and you're listening to The Frame Weekend.
The game Monopoly has come to life at McDonald's.
If you set foot inside a McDonald's anytime in the 90s or even just saw one of their commercials on TV, chances are you remember the McDonald's Monopoly game.
Play Monopoly. Do not pass go. Go directly to McDonald's.
Game pieces attached to drinks or French fry cartons or stuck inside magazines were supposed to be chances to win anything from a free burger up to an island vacation or even $1 million. But in reality, between 1989 and 2001, the average person had no chance of winning any of the $1 million prizes. As the new HBO documentary series McMillions lays out, the game was rigged.
In 2012, I was just laying in bed one night before I go to sleep, cruising through Reddit. And I saw a TIL, Today I Learned Nobody Really Won the McDonald's Monopoly Game.
McMillions is co-directed and co-written by Brian Lazarte and James Lee Hernandez. And it was Hernandez who first came across the story.
And I loved that game as a kid. My first job at 16 was at McDonald's during the time of all this. Kept looking into it. Really couldn't find much about it. And I put a Freedom of Information request in with the U.S. government. That took 3 years, a little more, to go through. And then I could contact the FBI agents, federal prosecutor, and the FBI and get rolling.
So there was a criminal trial. It started the day before 9/11, right? September 10th, 2001. So it was kind of lost in the headlines of 9/11. But there was a trial, and there was some evidence and some testimony that came out of that. But you were looking for something beyond that. What were you after in that Freedom of Information Act request?
Like online, you could find just some general details about it. But I wanted to know who was involved, how they got involved, how this entire thing transpired, because this crime happened over 12 years. There had to be all these ins and outs of what happened and who was involved. And I really wanted to know all that.
So, Brian, at what point did you get involved?
James reached out to me in the summer of 2017. He had just gotten the FOIA request back and had reached out to the federal agents, federal prosecutor. And they said this was their favorite case, that no one's ever contacted them about it before.
I think they called it a career case, right?
Very much a career case. And so we thought, okay, maybe there's a documentary in this, but do we have the characters to actually support that?
So there are a number of characters. I want to talk about one character in particular, and that is, you probably know, Doug Matthews, who is an FBI agent crossed with a circus performer. He has got more energy.
At the time, I was always looking for an undercover angle, even though I was being told, you don't want that, you don't want that. You know, I was always asking, what about this one? What about this one? Go get the bad guy, right? I wanted to burn down the criminal enterprise.
At what point do you meet Doug, and at what point is it obvious to you that you can tell a lot of the story through Doug?
One of the first phone calls was to Mark Devereaux,
who is the assistant U.S. attorney who prosecutes the case.
Correct. And in the middle of the phone call, Mark said, hey, I'm going to loop in Doug on our call. He was one of the main agents on the case. And I said, all right, cool. And as soon as Doug got on the phone, it was like, who is this guy? And then I met them at the FBI office in Jacksonville about 5 o'clock. And we didn't leave the FBI office till about midnight because Doug talked so much.
We're talking with James Lee Hernandez and Brian Lazarte about the HBO documentary series McMillions. So there are aspects of this story that mirror the movie Argo, and that involves the creation of a fake movie crew, which is basically created by the FBI with McDonald's knowledge to interview, and I'm using air quotes now on the radio, winners of some of the prizes. And these winners have been given winning tickets by a character we're going to talk about in a second. But the genius of that idea is he essentially gets them to describe their made-up story.
Why don't we go back to that day that you won in New Hampshire? And can you just sort of describe the day for us, what you were doing in the morning and at work? And then
it was a summer day. I wasn't working. It was Sunday, as a matter of fact. And there wasn't a whole lot of work to do. So, just browsing through the Sunday paper.
Flop sweating. He is so nervous. And it's riveting, but it's also kind of tough to watch, isn't it?
100%. It was important for the FBI to pretend like they were having fun, because they were supposed to be a McDonald's commercial production company. And Amy Murray, who was brought in from McDonald's to work undercover with the FBI, talks about that, you know, specifically in the first episode. And obviously, you know, it's golden material to work with. Just the idea of what they did, you couldn't script it. But, you know, when we first looked at that footage, you don't know really how to feel about it. Do you laugh at this person? Do you feel bad for them?
It's literally like watching a train wreck. You don't know if you're supposed to watch or not. You don't know if you're supposed to feel guilty because this person is being lied to, but they're trying to lie to the FBI. It's just this whole weird sensory overload when you see it.
There are two Jerrys at the center of this story. Explain who they are and how they connect.
So there is Jerome Jerry Jacobson, and he was the head of security for Simon Marketing, which is the marketing company that ran the game for McDonald's. And then there is Gennaro Jerry Colombo, and he was part of the Colombo crime family, was looped into this entire thing, and really helped explode how big this fraud was. Really early on, Jerry Jacobson, he's giving pieces to people he knows, but once he links in with a mob, they have the wherewithal to expand this out quite a bit.
James Lee Hernandez and Brian Lazarte are the co-directors and co-writers of the documentary series McMillions. It is on HBO. James and Brian, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Coming up on The Frame Weekend, as an actress, Kerry Washington managed crises for a fictional president in Scandal. As a producer of the new documentary, The Fight, she's championing the people who are challenging President Trump. It's The Frame Weekend. We'll be right back. It's The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. We are counting down the days until the California primary on Super Tuesday. It's the first time that the state has been able to weigh in this early in the primaries. And that means candidates have been coming to town and ads have been targeting Californians. Ted Johnson is the Washington correspondent for Deadline, where he covers politics and entertainment. Ted, welcome back to The Frame.
Thank you for having me.
So who came to town and what did they do?
Well, Amy Klobuchar was at the home of Lorraine Scheinberg. She's the widow of Sidney Scheinberg, who was a very top executive at Universal and also very politically active and in his career.
And Lorraine Scheinberg played the wife to Officer Brody in Jaws.
Yeah, and it kind of speaks to what type of support she's getting. People who are moderates in the entertainment industry, probably a little older than you may see from some of the Bernie Sanders side. And then Pete Buttigieg on Thursday, raising money at the home of Seth MacFarlane, co-hosted by Lee Daniels. Joe Biden was supposed to have an event this week in Southern California, but that was rescheduled because he has to spend so much time on the campaign trail after a pretty dismal performance in Iowa and New Hampshire.
I assume most of these events are relatively similar. You pay a couple of $1,000, you show up at somebody's house, maybe get a photo, shake hands, and hear a 20-minute speech. Do they all fall pretty much under that same pattern?
Yes, pretty much so. It's usually the candidate delivering a variation on their stump speech that you can hear in public on the campaign trail, sometimes throwing in a few insiderish comments and sometimes doing a Q&A with donors. But they do have a lot of similarities. Even the food can be quite similar. Usually they'll serve wine and light hors d'oeuvres. You don't see dinners that are too extravagant because, after all, the campaign actually has to foot the bill.
Who are the kinds of people who are hosting these events, and are they typically aligned with one candidate, or do they spread their love around?
You are seeing some of that, but I think what really distinguishes this presidential cycle versus past ones is here we are just 2 weeks out from Super Tuesday, and there are a lot of those traditional donors, the people who have been involved cycle after cycle, who have not declared their support for one candidate or the other. I'm thinking people like Steven Spielberg, Jeffrey Katzenberg, Haim Saban. So as an observer, it can be a little confusing. Just because someone has given to a candidate does not necessarily mean that they're going to vote for that person or they're going to endorse. A lot of people are just seeing how this plays itself out.
We're talking with Deadline's Ted Johnson about campaigning for president in Hollywood. Not that long ago, I remember, and you do as well, the town being pretty much split between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama during the primaries. Has one candidate really kind of gone to the top in terms of leading Hollywood attention and money right now?
Well, it's interesting because if you look at the numbers, Kamala Harris actually has collected more money from the entertainment business than any other candidate. But she's not even in the race anymore. She's followed by Pete Buttigieg, who has raised, I think it's $1.2 million so far from the entertainment business. It's quite extraordinary that he's raised that amount, given that a year ago he was an unknown. And he came in and really became kind of a darling of the entertainment industry very quickly. I think a lot of donors saw his candidacy as potentially historic. He'd be the first LGBT president. And they really won over by his message. They say, hey, we see shades of Barack Obama in Pete Buttigieg. Now, I also shouldn't discount Bernie Sanders. He's raised close to $900,000 from the entertainment business. And he has a very enthusiastic number of supporters, people like Adam McKay and Susan Sarandon and Michael Moore. They're out there on the campaign trail for him. It's just that he is not relying on these types of high dollar fundraisers. He's doing it through these small dollar contributions, and his message is definitely resonating, even in the elite circles of Hollywood.
So let's talk about the right side of Hollywood. It isn't very big, but have there been any conservative people in the industry who have come out and said things in favor of or given money to President Trump?
We have people who have come out in favor of Trump who've been with him very publicly from the start, people like John Voight. There is a reluctance to come out publicly and support President Trump because there is a lot of blowback. I've talked to Trump supporters who said they don't want their names associated with him because things are so polarized at this time. But if Bernie Sanders is the nominee, we'll see. I've talked to centrist donors who are very concerned about Sanders getting the nomination. They won't come out and say that that is going to force them into Trump's hands. They'll say, I'm just going to sit it out if he ends up being the nominee. But we'll see.
Ted Johnson is the Washington correspondent for Deadline, where he covers politics and entertainment. Ted, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Let's go.
It's the Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Last month, when we were covering the Sundance Film Festival, we saw a documentary produced by the actor Kerry Washington. It's called The Fight, and it tells the story of ACLU lawyers who are challenging the Trump administration.
I keep referring to these lawyers as our Avengers. You know, they are really these superheroes taking on such powerful figures.
The Fight is directed by Eli Dupre, Elise Steinberg, and Josh Kriegman. They made the 2016 movie Wiener, a documentary about the disgraced former congressman Anthony Wiener. At Sundance, I spoke with Dupre, Kerry Washington, and Dale Ho. He's the director of the ACLU's Voting Rights Project. Eli, I'm going to start with you.
Sure.
When you're trying to figure out what lawyers you're going to follow and what cases are interesting, how do you make that decision?
Well, for us, I mean, these were the big cases. These are the big cases. I mean, LGBT rights and voting rights and family separation, immigrant rights, and abortion rights are the sort of central conflicts of the American experience right now. Yeah. So we wanted to be where the action was, and it we just got lucky that the star lawyers running these cases happened to be very, very interesting, charismatic, charming weirdos.
Kerry, when did you get involved in this film and why was it personally important to you?
Yeah, you know, I think we all really got ignited when the decision came down from the federal courts to not allow the Muslim ban. That was such a phenomenal evening. Elise was there in Brooklyn.
President Trump's executive order igniting an immediate legal challenge. The ACLU, though, winning a temporary injunction against part of the travel ban.
Lawyers scrambling to free those two Iraqis detained at JFK Airport. Then just before 9 p.m., celebrations erupting when the ruling comes down.
God bless
I was home in LA watching it on television, but we had the same reaction of like, who's following these folks? Like these lawyers from the ACLU, they are going to be on the front line of every attack we get from this administration, and who's going to be there to witness it, to capture it for posterity? And so Elise, of course, grabbed her folks and her cameras and got started, and I called my team and said, who's doing this? How do I be a part of it? Is anybody on the ground with them? And they said, you know what? On the exact same day, the team from Wiener called and asked the same question, would you want to partner with them? And I said, yes.
Dale, when you let a camera crew in to not only watch you work, but also to see you struggle in your work and get ready for probably the biggest day in your life as a lawyer.
Yeah.
What is the conversation you're having with yourself?
Well, it was a little strange, I'll have to say. You know, when I go to court, you know, there's a kind of invulnerability that we try to project, right? We obviously get lots of surprises in the courtroom from time to time, but we have to act like, when we're lawyers, we have to act like we expected everything that happened was going to happen, like we're in control at all times. So letting a camera crew come in and see, you know, the preparatory phase where we're not in control, where, you know, I am messing up while I'm preparing for an oral argument in the Supreme Court was a little intimidating at first. But then once I sort of was prepping for the work in earnest, the case was so important, it just kind of became all I could focus on. And I kind of forgot that the crew was there.
Slightly complicated decision, yeah, in terms of what the question is that they're addressing. And in a slightly complicated way, you're not quite sure what they have ruled.
Right.
And this all unfolds in real time as you're trying to digest, I'm sure, a multi-page opinion and the dissent.
Yeah, we lost.
And let's just say you don't get it 100% right the first time you read through it.
I'd say I got 100% wrong, actually.
I was trying to be kind.
No, it's fine. When I read the opinion, I thought we had lost the case in the Supreme Court, that the court had ruled against us. I just take comfort in the fact that my boss, the legal director of the ACLU, thought the exact same thing when he was reading it. So I know it wasn't just me. It was a complicated opinion.
What the f***? I can't understand what's happening. Wait. We won on establishing that it was protection.
The issue was that the Trump administration wanted to put a question about citizenship on the census. That's something we haven't done in over 70 years. And the reason is because the government knows that if you add that question, fewer people will participate in the census. If we get a lower population count, that means it's going to change the way that political representation is distributed in this country, and it'll result in the misallocation of over $900 billion in federal funds annually.
We're talking with Eli Dupre, Dale Ho, and Kerry Washington about their documentary, The Fight. Kerry, there's a moment in the film where the ACLU decides to fight for the right of the, I don't think there's any other word to describe it, the racists who are marching in Charlottesville, Virginia, that they have as much of a right to march and protest as anybody else does. And that march ends with the murder of Heather Heyer. And there's a lot of really conflicted feelings inside the ACLU about the outcome of the ACLU's position. I want to ask you just about that moment in the film and what it reveals about how difficult it is sometimes to fight for people's right to speak, even if you find what they're speaking about to be reprehensible.
Yeah, for me, that part of the film is so important because I think it's one of those moments when you're reminded that this is not a propaganda film about the ACLU. This is an exploration of people who are at the front lines of this fight. And the fight is complicated. The fight to defend our civil liberties for all Americans is not always easy or simple, but it's important because the moment that we give up our freedoms for any person, everyone is at risk. So I think it's, for me, it's one of the most important parts of the film because it really is an affirmation that we're here to tell the truth. And we're not here to convince people. We're really here to expose the complexity of the time.
Eli, there's so many different ways to leave this film. You can be optimistic about some of the victories. You can be depressed about some of the losses. And certainly, even since you finished the film, some of the cases that were litigated have been relitigated, or there have been changes in policy, including very recently the travel ban. What's your take on the tone of the film at its end?
I mean, it's bittersweet. And I think that what we want audiences to walk away with, hopefully, is what the ACLU walks away with, which is, I think they are reinvigorated. I mean, every day they keep getting up and going back into the fight. It doesn't end. It's 2020. We're in an election year. And as a country, we're going to have to decide what way we want to go in November. We really want this movie to be part of the conversation. And I hope that our audiences are as energized for the coming fight as we are.
I think what Dale says in the film at the end is so powerful, because he really talks about the fact that they are in this fight and they are taking on this fight for us, but they can't do it alone, that it's going to take people in the streets. It's going to take everyday Americans figuring out, maybe my calling isn't to go to law school, but there's something I have that I can give to this fight.
Eli, Dale, and Carrie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having us.
That was the co-director of the fight, Eli Dupre, one of the subjects of the documentary, Dale Ho, and producer, Kerry Washington. The fight will be released later this year. And that is all we have for today. The Frame Weekend is edited and produced by Darby Maloney, along with producers Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, and Julia Paskin, with help this week from Emily Henderson. Eduardo Perez is our engineer. The Frame's theme music is by Taylor McFerrin, and the show's senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. Have a great weekend.